Stella, we finally got Colin Wright on the show.
I know. I've been such a fan for so long. And we finally got one. It's funny. It's funny that he hadn't come on before, but I'm so thrilled because this was a brilliant conversation.
I know. And, you know, one of the amazing things is that Colin was telling us his intellectual hero, the reason he got into biology in the first place, is the very famous scientist Richard Dawkins. And recently, Richard Dawkins retweeted Colin's presentation from your conference, your GenSpec conference, praising it and saying that it was, you know, incredibly wonderful or something like that. And it's just like, yeah, you know, Colin Wright basically got canceled from the world of biology and very, very bravely entered this world, speaking about things that used to be obvious and normal to say just a few years ago, and was really ostracized for it. So when your intellectual hero kind of praises your work and acknowledges that your presentation is brilliant, you're really on the right track. And it was just so cool. It was actually cool to interview Colin at this point in time because we were able to talk about that experience.
Yeah. And I was even delighted by proxy that Rich Dawkins had, you know, had tweeted Colin's presentation, which was from GenSpec. But, you know, Colin is clearly, when you listen to this interview, you'll see Colin is just such an advocate for evolutionary biology, as in he's truly, truly absorbed in his field. He loves it. He knows about it. And he's a really educated person who enjoys following knowledge and looking for patterns. But not only that, I've kind of got to know him in my own way, kind of through online kind of discourse. And, you know, he's an incredibly honorable man. It doesn't surprise me that he stood up and spoke about it. It doesn't surprise me at all that he has kind of just held the line, may I say, but that he has been really, really decent, and he's a truth seeker. He's a truth seeker in the larger sense of the word. And I'm just absolutely thrilled that we got to get him on, because he's one of those special people in the world.
And something that I think he does particularly well is kind of create analogies for us to understand complex scientific topics.
Yeah.
And one of the things we talk about today is this brilliant kind of diagram that he showed in his GenSpec conference, showing the difference between a parsimonious, simple, clear explanation for a phenomenon versus when scientific theories are based on ideology, they get very convoluted and they have to use these really complicated loop-de-loops, as you'll hear, to explain phenomena that are much more easily explainable in a simple way. So there's so much we touched on, but that was really important to flush out.
If people after the interview, and I bet you there will be people who'll want to hear more, I do recommend the GenSpec presentation. He did an extraordinary slideshow.
Yes.
And I remember at the time the kind of the tech people really kind of being hassled about the slideshow. And I was going, I think it'll be worth it because he's clearly into it. And then suddenly the slideshow was just really, really, really visual. It's a really good slideshow that goes with his talk. And it's well worth checking it out.
Yeah. We hope you enjoy this. I'll read a little bit about Colin from his bio, and then we'll jump right in. And if you are here on YouTube, please do like and subscribe. It really helps us out. And if you want to hear the extended version, actually, we have to say, in the extended version over on our Substack, we got into the most fascinating conversation about Colin's research on arachnid personality, spider personality, and wasp personality, and wasp queens, and what they can tell us about kind of authoritarianism. I mean, you've got to check it out. Parenting. If you like... Yeah, please. So, okay. Please check that out on the Substack. Yeah. So Colin Wright is an evolutionary biology PhD, Manhattan Institute fellow, academic advisor for the Society of Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, and a member of GenSpec's new think tank, the Killarney Group. Wright began writing publicly about issues of sex and gender in 2018. His articles have been published in the Wall Street Journal, Times, New York Post, Newsweek, City Journal, Quillette, and other major news outlets, as well as peer-reviewed journals and book chapters. He's been a guest on many popular TV shows and podcasts, such as The Joe Rogan Experience, Tucker Carlson Tonight, Trigonometry, and now Gender Widerlands Podcast. Please enjoy our wonderful conversation with Colin Wright.
Hi, I'm Stella O'Malley, a psychotherapist in Ireland.
And I'm Sasha Ayad, an adolescent therapist in the United States.
And this is Gender, A Wider Lens, a podcast dedicated to the shifting concepts around gender in our contemporary culture.
Through in-depth interviews, personal stories, and psychological exploration, we seek to open up the discourse around this hot-button issue.
Join us as we look at gender from a wider lens.
Hi, Stella, and welcome, Colin.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. It's so good to be here, finally.
Well, we're embarrassed.
Yeah, we haven't had you on sooner. Yeah,
it's all good.
And may I make this apology to all the, there's so many huge names that we haven't asked. And in a way, I think we moved from they're too big for us, we couldn't dare ask, to, oh God, we haven't yet asked, kind of seamlessly.
Yeah.
So preemptive apology to everybody.
No, I'm just happy to be here chatting with y'all. I've been listening for quite some time, so it's good to be on this side of the recording now. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's so great. And we're positive that our audience is going to be thrilled. We've had so many people asking about you. So finally, Colin is here. And hopefully will be the first of many conversations we have with you. Yeah. So there's a lot to cover. And I guess one place we could start, which actually one of our producers has been talking about this concept for so long. You wrote in 2022 a piece about on Reality's Last Stand, which is your excellent Substack, a piece about how the term transgender is actually this giant umbrella that encompasses such a variety of disparate phenomena that no wonder we see tons and tons and tons of people calling themselves transgender. And I wanted to just ask you if you could talk a little bit about that concept and how I think this is really important for listeners to understand. And sometimes I use this really weird phrase. I say, this isn't your grandmother's transsexualism, which is a very bizarre little phrase. But what I'm getting at is what we are calling trans today is not at all what we used to think of as like classic, longstanding gender dysphoria, excruciating, needs medicalization to relieve the distress, whatever. So can you talk a little bit about that piece?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that piece up because I think it's one of the more important ones I've written on the topic. And it kind of came out of me looking at the sort of the landscape of how people were talking about, you know, why do we see this huge spike in kids who are identifying as trans? Why is it, you know, biased towards girls? And it always would come down to these factions, you know, like the greater societal acceptance hypothesis. And then you have like the social contagion hypothesis. And these were sort of the ones that are duking it out in the trenches. And it just didn't seem to like be as clear to me that these are the only two options out there, because I had been doing some research for articles. And just the first step, I was like, oh, well, how are like our main organizations defining what it means to be transgender? So I went to like the American Psychiatric Association, the CDC, all these places. And I was super shocked, because to me, this is like, they were defining what trans is in ways that a lot of us would say like, oh, this is what they won't say, but they secretly mean. And to me, they were just saying it out loud. And the definition they all gave, there are subtle variations, but it's like an umbrella term. And they all start with that. Like, so they're all like taking each other's notes. And there's some copy and pasting going on, like an umbrella term for anyone whose identity or expression differs from the sex they would say assigned at birth. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they would even say that this sort of differences in sometimes they'd add behavior to an expression. And these were all rooted in sort of traditional stereotypes of masculine and femininity. Some would even actually include in parentheses masculine, feminine for men and women. And this was a shock to me, because it's like, okay, well, by this narrow definition, or this, I guess, super broad definition, sorry, if you're a girl and you're doing something that is not traditionally associated with your sex, this is the definition they're having of transsexual or transgender. And we can just think of so many traits this falls under, like a girl who has short hair. Well, that's not what's traditionally associated with being a girl. That's more like a boy. Or anyone who's homosexual. Being attracted to the same sex is something that's not traditionally associated with the sex. So all these things, gay people are subsumed under this definition of being transsexual. Tomboys are now under this definition, transsexual. Effeminate boys, they're transsexual or transgender. And so to me, it's just pretty clear that if the definition is so broad, if this is what they're learning in school, and this is what it's saying on like the gender-bred person and all the different gender cartoons they have out there, then it's no wonder. You don't even need a social contagion. It's right there coming out of our main institutions. It's in the classroom. That if you don't identify with the roles or stereotypes that are traditionally associated with your sex, you're trans. And what do kids think in their mind when they think of like, well, what does it mean to identify with the opposite sex? Well, they're just looking at stereotypes, and this is exactly what's going on. So we don't need to talk about whether or not it's greater societal acceptance or whether it's a social contagion. It's just the new definition. Like, and I even explain how I would fit this definition, and most people would fit this definition, and the audiences in my talks, you know, the women aren't wearing gowns in there. The guys aren't all like G.I. Joe, super jacked. Like, some women have short hair. Some of the guys had long hair. And so it's almost everyone is trans under this definition. So it's no wonder we see this. And then there was an added little bit about how like the roles we tend to have for females in society tend to be a little more rigid. And so it's easy to sort of break a stereotype that is traditionally associated with being a girl or a woman. And so no wonder we see more girls thinking that they're boys, because girls are more likely to sort of, since the stereotype is more rigid, it's easier for them to sort of break that norm and be considered now part of the trans umbrella. So that was my my thoughts. That's what that piece was trying to outline.
That's interesting too, because I've heard people, and I'm open to hearing your thoughts on this, but I've heard people say that actually the kind of box, the gender box, is more rigid for males, and girls have more flexibility insofar as, like, you know, women wear trousers and women can be somewhat athletic and tomboys, and very few people will say, you're not a real woman if you do that. Whereas I think there may be an argument to say that if a boy steps outside of the traditionally masculine gender role, he might be more likely to be teased or something like that. So I'm wondering what was on your mind when you kind of pointed to the female role being more rigid. There might be examples I'm not thinking of right now, but what was on your mind when you said that?
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, it's like the male gender roles are more heavily policed. But it's only when they're going someplace that's like overtly feminine, like if they're wearing a dress or if they're just, you know, putting on any sort of makeup or doing things like that. But the male stereotype, you know, it's not like too focused on grooming. You can just sort of wake up and do whatever with your hair, go to school. It's just everything's disheveled. You don't need to be particularly super manly. You can just be like whatever. You don't need to be explicitly feminine to be considered like breaking, you know, a male stereotype. Women tend to be, I guess, more like fluid in their sexuality. So we see some of this stuff, but like the strict stereotype for like womanhood, I guess that I would say, from what I've read, is kind of seen as more rigid, even if it's not policed as heavily, like socially, like there's more like people that police gay men, for example, than they police, you know, lesbians in their social presentation. Like an effeminate male is more likely to get beat up by a bunch of guys, whereas you know, you might get some bullying with women, but it tends to be less fierce and socially enforced than sort of male gender nonconformity, if that makes sense. I think there was literature that bared that out, but it's been a while since I looked at it. But that was my impression of it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I had never thought of it like that, because I've always thought, you know, the boys get a hard time. But you're right, there's a difference between policing and what you're talking about. So the policing is one thing, but the other aspect of it is very interesting.
We want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, GenSpect and Therapy First. GenSpect is an international organization committed to fostering a healthy approach to sex and gender. The team and members of GenSpect strive to promote high-quality, evidence-based care for gender nonconforming individuals. GenSpect is pleased to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender with their recently published Gender Framework, and they continue to hold conferences around the world. Visit genspect.org to learn more.
Therapy First is a non-profit worldwide professional association of mental health providers who view psychotherapy as the appropriate first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. Therapy First supports psychotherapists working with gender dysphoric youth and young adults and offers public education on mental health and psychotherapy. Visit therapyfirst.org to learn more.
Now, back to the show.
What is your thoughts about the kind of the way that we have mixed up sex and gender? And, you know, like I had a very interesting conversation with Helen Joyce there a week or two ago, and she was basically saying, well, you know, sex has become a synonym with gender in legal parlance in the UK. And I thought, right. And I thought, well, I wonder, should we as a movement go with that then? Should we just say, well, okay, it's a cinnamon, therefore, you know what I mean? Or should we keep it separate, that gender is a social construct, or, you know, effectively masculinity or femininity, while sex is biological? What's your thoughts on that? Because I just thought that opened a door to me with, well, isn't it simpler if we just made it a cinnamon then? Synonym,
yeah.
Other than a cinnamon,
I mean, it would be pretty simple, but like I've been really shocked at how the inability of people generally to like keep these two things separate, yeah, in their minds, just because, you know, sex is a very specific term. It only refers to, yeah, like one. Well, I mean, it could mean the act, or it could mean whether or not you're male or female. But people are better at disentangling those things. One's, you know, a verb versus a noun type of thing. But yeah, the word gender is does have so many meanings in society. And so I tend to want to not make them synonyms, at least in law, because there is ambiguity there. Whereas if we're just talking about biological sex, there really isn't any ambiguity, even though a lot of the activists are trying to add the ambiguity in there by publishing papers saying like, oh, sex refers to all these different things. And it's not necessarily, mm-hmm, just gametes, but it can be hormones and all those things. Mm. So they're trying to make it ambiguous, but at least for now, it's much less ambiguous than the term gender. So I'm all for like keeping that wall between sex and gender. I don't care what people want to do with the gender stuff. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, I remember maybe it was like 2012 or 2013 when we were all sort of asked by our fellow liberals to, you know, just accept that sex is one thing and gender is something different, and you can be a male but identify as a woman, and woman is a gendered term. And a lot of us sort of went along with this, and I did too at the time, just being like, okay, as long as everyone's, you know, on the same page about what biological sex is. And then it was just like instantaneous, as soon as they got enough people to agree with that, then they just started like flipping the words, and now I identify as a male. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Like, I thought this, yeah, is man and woman. I thought those are the gender terms. Now they're identifying as sex terms. And then it's just used willy-nilly. They switch between sex and gender in order just to confuse people and get what they want. So, yeah.
Yes, a lot of times I hear people using this term trans male, and I never know what they actually mean.
The hell is that?
I'm like, yeah, are you a trans-identified female, or do you mean a trans man, or do you mean a male who's identifying? Like, it's really interesting, and the word male and female now is losing its sense of meaning. And this kind of like segues us into a point that I'd really wanted to ask you about. And we will link your GenSpec presentation in the notes.
Oh, yeah. It was
so
amazing,
unbelievable.
Colin. Oh, thank you.
And for those who don't know, do you want to talk about the really famous scientist who retweeted this particular section of your presentation?
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't he? It was phenomenal.
It was amazing. So Richard Dawkins, who is like my big time hero, he's the reason I wanted to become an evolutionary biologist.
Oh.
He studied animal behavior. That's why I studied animal behavior for becoming an evolutionary biologist. So he's just been like a major intellectual hero for me for a very long time. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for Dawkins. And he put on Twitter, he said, you know, he posted the talk that I gave at GenSpec, and he said, I think he said it was superbly clear and totally correct.
Oh.
And so to me, that just, you know, it made my year, it made my life. So
oh,
I can die happy now.
I'm so thrilled, cool, because it was such a good talk. And the slides and the talk, it was just phenomenal. It was really, really brilliant. And I'm so pleased that you got the recognition that you deserved. And you did. You really did.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, it was a big validation too. I mean, I never, like, I understood like what biological sex is. I think I can explain it pretty well. But I was just thinking back to like a lot of the colleagues who had just sort of pushed me out of the their circles, you know, calling me like a transphobe and a bigot for just literally saying all the stuff I've been saying in the talk. And I know that they were all really big fans of Dawkins, and to have someone like Dawkins, and also Jerry Coyne, who is a big hero of mine, both coming out and supporting it, it's just like, take that. So yeah. it's just really vindicating, and it's just, I'm just glad that they agree with it. If they didn't, then it would suck because I would still disagree with them. But it's just good to have that type of support, that mainstream big support, where it's like, okay, well, I'm definitely not fringe if like one of the best evolutionary biologists of our time is endorsing it. So
yeah, that's the thing. I mean, about this whole weird world, I think all of us, I mean, I don't know you personally, but I guess all of us were pretty normal people within our respective fields up until this gender stuff came up. Yeah. I mean, I didn't hold any fringe views. No. And I think my view now, which is like, adolescence is a time of experimentation. We shouldn't double down on anything a 12-year-old says. Like, that's pretty normal stuff. Yeah. But, you know, so the point is, I mean, this particular talk was about sex is a binary. And I have a lot of questions about it. But one of the things that I particularly remember that really stuck with me, because I am a pretty visual person, is you were talking about the heliocentric model of understanding the planet orbits, and then the sex is a binary model. Can you just break that down and explain like what visually we were seeing this on those really slides? Because it was really powerful.
So I was using this as an analogy based on what I'm seeing happening in sort of the biological sciences and how they're discussing what biological sex is. So we've known, there's a time we didn't know what sex was. We knew that, you know, from humans that females giving birth and males, but we didn't know like that it was sperm and ova, and that this was the distinguishing characteristic like for all of reproductive sexually reproducing species that have, you know, that combine different sized gametes. So there was a big question before. And when we discovered gametes, this was something that was really, groundbreaking. It explained so much variation. It helped explain areas in nature where we see sort of like sex role reversals and behaviors and things like seahorses, where it's the males that are giving birth, and ecological reasons we might see those things. It's just like, it helps explain the patterns, and it helps explain the exceptions to the rule in a really elegant ways too. The sex binary just rooted in sperm and ova and no other gamete. It's just incredibly powerful, starting from a place that's so simple. So we would call this sort of parsimonious in science. You just need to understand so very few things, and it explains a lot of complexity. And this principle, the principle of parsimony, also known as like Occam's razor, it basically states that, you know, you shouldn't needlessly add complexity to a model unless you're really getting like a high payoff in, equally or more payoff in how much it can explain in the world. So a good area in the history of science where this occurred was in sort of when we were trying to decide or discover our place in the solar system. So before, because for religious reasons or just we were ignorant about, you know, looking at the planets and how the stars are moving and how we're moving in relation to the sun, we had all this hubris, and we thought that, you know, the humans, Earth must be the center of the universe, or at least our solar system. We thought the solar system kind of was the universe. So all the models that they made to try to explain all the weird trajectories of the planets, they were all based on assuming that the Earth was at the center. Okay, but we're not at the center. And so in order to explain these really complex movements of Mars and the retrograde motion and everything like that, they had to add these things called epicycles to these models, which was sort of like, you could think about like the planetary orbits we see now. They would add like these orbits upon orbits, or like these loop-de-loops that the planets were doing. And there was really no explanation for why these occurred. It was just like, well, we need it. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways. And if he wants loop-de-loops, we're going to make loop-de-loops. And the models got like so complex, but you know, they were seemingly explaining things. I mean, they were actually getting pretty accurate. Like you could make shockingly good predictions based on these models, but they were just so like encumbered, so complex and heavy. And, you know, like, oh, when you add this loop-de-loop, then something else springs over on this side of the model. And now we can't explain this as well. Like we'll add more loop-de-loops. And it's just... It just keeps growing and growing, and you're getting incremental payoffs for adding like way more complexity as you go along. And so then it took one, you know, Galileo and, you know, others observing the universe. They said, like, well, what if we just like re-examine our assumptions about the model? What if perhaps based on some observations, if we just move the Earth not at the center, we center the sun, and we assume that everything's orbiting the sun instead. And when you do that, it just, everything is so elegant all of a sudden. You don't need any of these loop-de-loops. You know, there was initial, they needed to make the model a little bit more complex early on because they assumed that because of God's greatness, all the orbits had to be perfectly circular. And so they had to add like, okay, well, here's a little addition, you know, add a little more complexity. Oh, the orbits are ellipses and of different, you know, degrees. But that additional complexity paid off in spades because you could explain Mars retrograde motion, all the comets and everything and how everything works. You don't need the loop-de-loops. It's just way more clear and clearly right and verified from observations and everything now. And so this is kind of that's the way science is supposed to go. You know, we go from complexity, we make a few small moves, all of a sudden it's a windfall moment. We have like these amazing moments of just like, you know, holy crap, this is it, eureka. And so we had that already in the science of what sexes are. And now we're seeing papers that are doing things like, you know, this multivariate models of animal sex. We're measuring the sex of animals based on their chromosomes and hormones and their behavior and all this stuff. And like the models they use are just so complex and there's all these zigzag things and the graphs are all over the place. Just because they're trying to insist, they're trying to, you know, decenter gametes from the sort of sexual solar system, and they can make certain predictions, but the way they solve them is adding more complexity instead of trying to make it more simple. And it's just, it's being driven just by pure ideological political fervor. This is not rooted in reality. We just need to go back to the previous model, which they like to call like, oh, it's the old way of thinking. Well, like, well, sometimes we get things right and we don't need to like improve upon them. Like, we're not going to go back and to epicycles anytime soon just because like, oh, we've been thinking that same way for 100, you know, 1,000 years or whatever. It's like, we got it right and we can move on now. Yeah. But they're trying to add sort of these epicycles, I would say, to the model of biological sex. And that's just, it's creating needless complexity and confusion. So,
wow.
That's so the way I like to think about it.
It's so interesting and it's so postmodern to kind of start adding all stuff like basically everything you know is wrong. Let's start again. Let's question everything. And it's like, really? We went through all that knowledge finding, all that like standing on the shoulder of giants from Socrates and Plato onwards to get to where we are so that we could enjoy great literature and music and beauty and food. And there's so much. And instead we've just kind of slunk back into kind of agonizing over things that we know. We've established our knowledge.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that brilliant cartoon you made, Colin. Like you said earlier, Sasha, we haven't moved. Everybody else moved, if you follow me. Like me and you as psychotherapists, we're just saying bog standard, you know, adolescents go through experimentation, while psychotherapists near us have just shut off. And it's the same. Do you want to explain your cartoon? Because it's such a brilliant cartoon. And I know one day I will get my copy. Colin has sent me a copy and it got lost.
It got lost in the mail. So I made this little cartoon. I called it like my political journey, but it's kind of funny because during the whole journey, like I've stayed in the same place. So it starts off, it has like three different timelines, basically. It's like these three different stacked views of the political left-right spectrum. And I think the first one is in 2008, and it's me like comfortably on the center left. And then to the left of me is someone labeled my fellow liberal. And then, you know, off on the right, there's the conservative, and everyone is just sort of happy and content where they are. And then in like, I think it's 2012 is next. Then the my fellow liberal, now with a question mark, it begins to run to the left. I'm staying in the same place. The conservative is in the same place, but as they're running to the left, they're pulling out the far end of the left of the spectrum with them. And so the center is now like coming towards me and I'm getting a little worried face. And then we move, I think 2021 is the last one. And, you know, they've moved so far to the left on this issue that the center has now passed me and that I'm center right now, even though I've stayed in the same place and my views haven't changed. And so now I'm being called like, you know, a far right bigot because, you know, I don't agree with them. And, you know, people have criticized that a lot. It's a cartoon that Elon Musk shared, so it went like super viral and it was on like all the news programs for a week.
It's brilliant.
It was bizarre.
I was going to say that is the best explanation of what I believe has happened to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I was far left of the center. And now all of a sudden, so that's great example.
It resonated with so many people. You know, a lot of people, like, they try to debunk the cartoon, like you can debunk a cartoon. It's a little funny political cartoon.
But they will
cartoon.
Try, Colin.
Yeah,
they will
and
try.
It's just like, yeah. And so I had an article in the Wall Street Journal about it, explaining like the cartoon and stuff. And it was really had to do, it's not like, I'm not saying the right didn't move and change at all. It's just like really on these, you know, three fundamental principles. It's like issues of free speech, what I always thought were like really highly valued, you know, things like women's rights and things like that. Well, now we can't even define what a woman is. And so it's, how do you be the party of women's rights when you don't know what a woman is? And then things just like identity politics and sort of the left moving away from, you know, judging people by the content of their characters instead of the color of their skin. We've sort of abandoned that. So that's really what that political spectrum thing was about for me. There's plenty of ways we can talk about how like the right has moved and like, but you know, for me, at least my values that are most important. That's what the landscape looked like for me. It was bizarre when that got shared, and it's been fun seeing everyone like post their own versions of it from their perspective. Well, and I'm just glad it's like, facilitated a lot of fun.
We should do our own cartoon, Sasha, for psychotherapists. Like how bog standard psychotherapists, and now we're suddenly considered really, really brave psychotherapists for saying really fairly basic things.
It applies to so many things. Like I always tell people, like I'm just a normal biologist from like 2010. Like I'm
that's what I was going to ask you.
Down the middle, like nothing crazy.
Did this happen to you as an evolutionary biologist? Did you watch, like myself and Sasha have watched our psychotherapists, our fellow psychotherapists, really kind of adopt new thinking around things that was not taught in college? Did you see the shift with the evolutionary biologists?
Yeah, that's what made me speak up early on. You know, I had sort of, I was maybe really getting worried about this mostly and taking notice in like 2016 to about the whole people trying to abolish the sex binary thing. People, you know, because as you're in academia, you start like, following a professor and they follow you back and you have your graduate cohort and you follow all them. And so you this was on like on Facebook and stuff. So I would see the stuff they're posting and they would post articles and some of the students and, you know, in postdocs work, liking them and stuff. They'd post articles like Anne Fausto Sterling's Five Sexes and, maybe sex is a spectrum and sex isn't really binary according to this Nature article. And it was just stunning to me. And I thought I was going crazy. Maybe I just don't understand the terms that they're using because clearly they can't be saying like that biological sex is a social construct. And so I would just like respond like so politely. I'm just curious, like I don't think they got it right on what they're talking about when they mean what sex is. And then, you know, I was expecting just a normal, we disagree, here's some reasons why, and we could have a normal, you know, back and forth as people who care about biology. But it was just immediately a wave of just like, you're parroting right-wing homophobics, transphobic talking points, all this stuff. And I was like, whoa.
Dog.
And so I kind of just locked down because I was looking for jobs. I was looking for postdoc jobs. And I was a postdoc. I was looking for professor jobs. It's like, I can't just have people calling me like transphobe and the things where people can Google.
Yeah.
And it, you know, took a little time for me just to like really investigate it more. Like, am I going crazy or are they the crazy ones? And, you know, I got fairly confident, they are actually saying that the sex isn't real and that's completely nuts. And then I looked at the consequences with like, you know, the gender affirming care and the women's sports and all that stuff that came after. At first it was just like people are wrong about biology and like let me just clear something up. And then once I saw like, this is having mega consequences, it's not just like this cloistered academic debate like the whatever, you know, who does this affect? And so I just started talking about it publicly. You know, I did an article in Quillette in 2018 about it. And then that's been history ever since because that went super viral and then no one else was talking about it really. And so I just kind of became the go-to person to to talk about it.
And it was very brave of you. And if I'm right, you didn't get the positions that your career went a different direction as a result.
Yeah. So I had, there was a massive campaign to sort of get me canceled and run me out of academia. You know, people were posting on job boards that Colin Wright is a transphobe and a white supremacist. You know, just throwing that in there for good, good measure.
Well, you do have a Nashville sign behind you, so I mean, I obviously.
But at the time, I was living in Pennsylvania, so.
Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah, and so it was really, really intense. And then I had posted like a Twitter, a tweet about, you know, just basically talking about Lisa Littman's article and saying that, like, oh, it was an article I was posting about. Talking about like Sweden saw like a 5,000% increase in trans identifying kids. And I just tweeted like social contagion, and everyone said like, oh, I'm saying that trans people are a virus. And it was really intense. Like people were calling places I had applied to and just, yeah. So I think they were probably pretty successful in like ruining my reputation. And so I left of my own will because I figured that it was just going to be really, really difficult for me to do well. And I had universities reach out where they told me, you know, sort of behind the scenes on a phone call, because I didn't want to put it in email, just like, you know, the department really liked your resume, but like it has to go through HR first. And like, there, it's not going to go through because of your public comments on this. I'm just like, well, great. So,
yeah. I want to ask more about that, because it really strikes me that your initial observation of these weird ideas and your pushback and then the pushback against your pushback, all of that seems to have been encapsulated in the online space, like started with these Facebook posts, following your, you know, postdoc friends or whatever. When you were in academia and you were working on your PhD and you were interacting with like real people, were you seeing any of this, or was it like, because I mean, I kind of sometimes feel like for me, I have two separate lives. I have my in-person real life where everyone seems pretty normal. And then in my online life where things are just so crazy. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know you were at the time you were searching for work, you were in the process of applications and stuff. But when you were in like a university setting around other people, were you seeing this stuff in real life?
So when I was in undergrad, I saw none of it. None of it at all. When I was in graduate school, I didn't see it from any of the faculty, and initially none of the postdocs. And then, you know, once I started seeing people like, you know, posting the things on Facebook, it became sort of a topic. And definitely I was shocked to know how many of the graduate students in my cohort were, you know, buying into this stuff and were and had these ideas, and some of the younger postdocs. So it was there in the younger crowd, but definitely not in the older, you know, more established faculty, tenure track people. And, you know, it's just gotten worse since, because, you know, those older faculty, they retire or they don't want to deal with this stuff. So as they're pushed out, the pipeline problem now is you have the sort of more radical activists moving into those tenured spots. Yeah. And now we see, you know, a lot of these articles that are coming out in like, well, we had the Nature, the big Nature one of, you know, sex redefined. Gotcha. We have hormones and behavior. In my talk, I think I go through like six or seven maybe of these most recent ones. And there's new ones coming out like almost every week about like breaking the binaries in sex and how it leads to better understanding of ecology and evolution. And it's just, you know, a lot of times, sometimes they don't even like mention gametes at all. It's just like, this is bizarre. And they'll have explicit calls for activism, like this is a call to arms or something in the discussion section. It's like, I couldn't imagine writing sentences like that in my scientific papers, like on spider biology, like a call to arms amongst arachnologists. Like, the language is completely insane. And it's really taken over a lot. And these things get sort of idea laundered now. They get cited as like, you know, here's the latest breaking stuff on the biology of sex, and it's hard to counter by citing things because they'll just like, oh, well, those are really old studies. It's like, well, again, I'm citing the
like the foundational, like the canon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's this is why I give the talks and why I keep talking about it, because it's now like fully established in the biological sciences, at least in the literature. And it's, you know, I think one of the only articles pushing back on it is one that I wrote with Emma Hilton. A book chapter and a peer-reviewed academic book from Routledge. So hopefully we'll get some more of these. We're in the works of just kind of getting pushed back within the journals, but you really have to find like the right journal and the right editor who's willing to sort of take these things. So it's a bizarre time.
We hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as we are. We just wanted to take a quick moment and say thank you to all of our listeners. Your support helps us to keep the lights on and the mics hot.
We recently made the switch to Substack so we could build a more robust listener community. Visit widerlenspod.com and check out the different subscription tiers.
For just $8 a month, premium subscribers get access to weekly bonus content, discussion posts, and more.
And founding members get the inside track on who's coming up on the show, with the ability to submit their own questions for our esteemed guests.
For those of you who are in need of parenting support and resources, we each have parent coaching membership groups. Plus, you can buy our book, When Kids Say They're Trans.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe, and get involved in the lively discourse in the comments section.
Thank you so much. Now, back to the show. I kind of have a feeling that people who are writing those journal articles and these publications, they feel kind of safe behind the, I guess, the distance of the screen and the pen. And it feels like such a language-based movement. And that's why I asked about real life versus the online life, or even the academic journal life, because part of me feels really curious, like, would those people in a real conversation, two people in the flesh looking at each other in the face, would they really say to you, no, actually, I think that the old model that explains reproduction was wrong? Like, I mean, I don't know if people really buy it. Sometimes I think people are so spun up in these like convoluted ideas that sound, I guess, okay enough on paper if you're not paying attention. But I don't know if people, like, in an embodied way, do they believe this? Like biologists? I don't know. I have a really hard time believing that, especially biologists. Like, I could see philosophers or like literature people, like I could see them buying it because it's a bit esoteric, but I don't know. I have a hard time believing that these biology people really, really believe what they're writing.
I think they do believe what they're writing, honestly. Because, I mean, a lot of biologists, they don't study, like, sex per se. Like, it's a very narrow field of people who are studying, like, the evolution of anisogamy, of, like, sperm and eggs. And these people understand what's going on here. But then, you know, I studied animal behavior, so I had a really good education in what defines males and females. Because when you're looking at nature and you see animals behaving a certain way, one of the first questions is, like, well, are they male or female? Because there's an incredibly, you know, diverse downstream consequences of being male or female. And so I remember like several classes I took as an undergrad that just had huge segments of the classes of just like how sperm and egg anisogamy evolved, the consequences, you know, the patterns you see in nature based on that, the universal definitions of what males and females are. But a lot of places don't get that type of, you know, foundational education. Especially doctors, shockingly. Like, you would think that like a medical doctor would have, you know, this foundational understanding, but they don't care how sex is defined universally. They don't care if it applies to nematodes, if it applies to humans. They care about just like humans particularly. And so when they're looking at the sex of an individual, they have a really myopic view of what sex is, which is, you know, and we look in humans and we see that, oh yeah, we have sperm and ova, but we also have, you know, secondary sex characteristics. We have hormones and things like that. And they just don't have like the outside reference of just to know that, well, there's secondary sex traits and there's primary sex traits. And they're more interested in looking at sex. You know, they split it up into multiple traits because as a doctor, it's easy to diagnose if there's something that's happened along sort of that chain where if, you know, if you're a male and you have really low testosterone, that's like a red flag. Oh, maybe you have testicular cancer. Or if you're a female and you have really high testosterone, maybe you have ovarian cysts. And so it's like a pragmatic thing where they like say like, oh, what's your, you know, what's your genetic sex? What's your hormonal sex? What's your, you know, that type of thing. It's pragmatic and it's like these operational definitions, but they don't quite have the stand back and look at the wide picture of like, well, no, what actually makes somebody male or female? It's actually has nothing to do with whether you have breasts or a beard or the type of genitals that you have. It's really just all about the type of gamete you have the function to produce. And so the people you think that would be the best on this, like medical doctors, are actually some of the worst. And a lot of biologists, you know, if they're doing test tubes and they're, you know, microbiologists, or whatever, they're not studying this directly. They don't have, they haven't received it. So they're just misinformed about what sex is, and they're sort of going to the medical literature or something that says sex is a, you know, a umbrella term for things like, you know, that that includes various traits like chromosomes and you know, hormones, and it sounds good, but it's just not quite correct when you actually drill down onto what it is.
My interpretation, and forgive me because I am definitely not at my best in this world, but my interpretation was that there was a lack of scientific journals that had the foundational proofs. Like, they didn't, like, there isn't, presumably there isn't much literature saying that water is wet, or that most humans have five digits, and you know, most human, you know what I mean? That those very basic pieces of knowledge, like babies are girls are boys, that we don't have the journals to kind of cite. And that was that was a kind of an almost a lack, when suddenly this postmodern kind of idea came in saying, but how do we know that? Is this true? But something you've just said there made me think, we've also kind of developed our thinking from Darwin further on, and until we've really crystallized what is female and what is male. But I'm not sure if I'm right to, am I right in both of those points, or?
I'm trying to get a grip of what the first, what was the first main?
The first one was, we don't have literature to cite basic facts.
Yeah, yeah. It's because there's a lot of, you know, in science we have like the basic observation that like everyone can see is like a phenomenon that is like clear. And then we write papers like to explain this phenomenon that everyone can agree is like definitely going on. And rarely you have to state in the paper like that the phenomena is indeed going on. Usually the papers are like investigating the mechanisms that bring about this phenomenon. Mm-hmm, yeah. But everyone can agree, like, there's the sun, or, you know, you don't have like evolutionary biologists aren't citing Darwin anymore, being like, evolution is real. Like, it's just like, okay, we've observed that. We've observed the fossil record. We've seen it.
We're past that.
We're past that. Yeah, yeah. So we don't need to like cite. I mean, I actually did, because I like enjoyed citing Darwin's like Origin of Species in some of my papers, but you don't see it very often. You don't see like, Stella said, like, water is wet, or that, like, you know, ducks like water, or, you know, things like that. Things,
birds fly.
You know, massive objects, you know, pull each other. Things fall to the ground. Those are just the basic observations. So we don't have it. Yeah. And so when the activists ask for like, well, show me the citation that there's only two sexes, it's like, oh my goodness. And then here they'll have like, here's 20 citations saying that it's not. And it's like, oh my God.
It's extraordinary. was my second question. Cause yeah, that was my read of it. And I thought, wow, isn't that kind of extraordinary position to be in? But yeah, the second point I was trying to make was something along the lines of, from what I've read around the whole intersex conditions and all the kind of the evolution of our understanding of it, it seems to me that in the 60s and 70s, they made lots of mistakes, that we hadn't really got the medical technology to fully understand which intersex children were male and which were female. But now we have developed our, so in fairness to everybody who might be kind of, because I often give talks around this, and I almost inevitably would get somebody put their hand up and talk about intersex and say it's not so clear. And I think, from what I've read, and you can correct me, Colin, but from what I've read, I'm like, in fairness, it hasn't been so clear for a very small number of people until now. I think it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's something I mentioned in the talk, that is an area of confusion, I would say, like, on both sides of the sort of debate on this thing about, like, about intersex people and like what the sex binary is referring to. So I mentioned in like my talk how a lot of people would say like, oh, the sex binary is XX and XY. That's the binary. But really the sex binary just refers to the fact that, or you can say, instead of saying sex is binary, you can replace that with there are only two sexes. But that statement doesn't actually require that, like, every single individual who's ever existed, currently exists, and will ever exist, can be, like, definitively put into either a male or a female category. Because being a male or a female, this is an endpoint of development, you know? Mm-hmm. Like an alligator embryo, it doesn't have a sex, you know, it's determined based on temperature. And so at some point along development, it begins developing down a male and a female pathway, and becomes male or female. And I think it's important for us to leave open the possibility that someone could have a very complex intersex condition where, you know, it's pretty baffling. And, you know, maybe for these very rare exceptions, we can say that this person does not have a determinable sex. It's, you know, undefined or whatever. A lot of people don't want to accept that because then they think they have to accept this idea that, like, you know, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And that's definitely true. They will try to do it. But we can still say that, you know, even if some people might not be, you know, very easy to classify, or even if we say some people aren't classifiable because they have such a complex medical, you know, intersex condition, it doesn't mean that we all have intersex conditions. It doesn't mean we're all somehow ambiguous to some degree. The vast majority of people are clearly either male or female. And that matters for everything that we care about, you know, sports and,
you made a lovely
care and all this stuff.
You made a nice analogy about a coin that if it lands
Yeah. So when people are male or female, you know, it's kind of like flipping a coin in the sense that, like, a coin has two faces on it. It's got a heads and a tails. For most people, you know, I would say for people who are male or female, it's not like they're 70% male or female. You're either male or female. You know, it's like I'm just as male, or you are the Dwayne The Rock Johnson is just as much of a male as, you know, Richard Simmons is a male, even though they're wildly different on almost every axis of personality and body type you can imagine. Like, there's not actually a difference of maleness there. There might be a difference of, like, masculinity, but not of, like, being male. And so, you know, they're both 100% male, even if they differ in so many other traits. And so it's kind of like flipping a coin. Like, when you flip a coin, you're not going to flip a coin and look under it and be like, it is 67% heads. It's going to be one or the other. But they've actually done sort of these trials with nickels, because they have, like, a flat, very flat edge. And, like, one out of every every 6,000 flips on, like, a very flat surface will land on its edge. And that's actually very close to the frequency of intersex conditions. It's like one out of 5,500 for people who are at least appear sexually ambiguous at birth. The vast majority of those can be definitively put into male or female buckets, you know, just looking a little bit more under the surface. But, you know, if we could say that the existence of an edge of a coin doesn't mean that heads and tails are social constructs. They're still very real things, and it still matters for deciding outcomes of, you know, of a bet or, you know, making decisions and things like that. So, this is something that, like, Alice Drager tries to do. And I think I developed this analogy for her because she would say that, you know, looking at the intersex body, which she called hermaphrodites in her book, like, doesn't just raise questions about, you know, that particular body, but about all bodies, you know, about what being male or female is. And it's like, no, like, just because someone is ambiguous doesn't make us all somehow cast into this, like, undefined category and, oh, we can't make any decisions. Let's just let people identify however they want to. Like, that is actually just a complete non sequitur. And it, you know, it sounds profound. It's what we'd call, like, a deepity. It's like, ooh, but it's really just, it's nonsense. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
I want to name this episode Deepities and Loop de Loops.
Yeah. Gotta get the loop de loops in.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about something that I've been thinking a lot about, just because that's what I like to do on weekends. And I've never heard anyone else talk about this. As someone who studies, you know, animal behavior and reproduction, have you any thoughts about what's happening now as human beings use hormonal and surgical interventions to modify their kind of sex signaling? So my understanding is that sex signaling is the way we either kind of with our physical bodies or with our behavior kind of signal to our potential mates that we are available, interested, wanting to whatever, get down. And of course, you know, we can say that women who have breast augmentations and plastic surgery, like, they're enhancing their sexual signaling. So it's not like people don't do this, but we're now having kind of cross-sex sexual signaling where you have biological males with secondary sex characteristics that are female, like breasts and, like, voluptuous lips, and they change their face shape, and women with beards. And I'm really curious, like, do we have any idea about what this does or what's there to think about here?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it has much of an impact for, like, you know, the future evolution of our species or anything like that. You know, I think just, and I don't expect it's going to reach a point of, you know, being such a high proportion of society that, like, most people in most contexts aren't going to be able to be pretty confident that the person they're hitting on is the sex that they believe that they are. I mean, there will be an increase in false positives to be potentially wary of. I mean, back when I was single looking on Tinder, I remembered, like, some, you know, if there's like a trans woman on there, you know, they would maybe hide in a certain way or have a certain light, and I'd be like, oh, and I would, like, swipe right, it's my Twitter handle, on someone, and only later to find out, like, oh, this is, like, thankfully they put, you know, trans in their bio, because, like, now I know, because their photos were sort of deceptive.
Yeah.
In a very specific way. But I think it's easy to navigate. I don't really think it's probably more difficult to navigate if you're, like, in sort of that community where you're not really sure what people's sex are and they're using gendered terms that are all over the place. So it's really difficult to even ever find out and rude to ask in probably a lot of their according to them. But if you're just, like, I don't want to say normal, but in the vast majority of people who aren't sort of in this ideology of deconstructing sex from gender, and I can't see it really having major consequences and changing, rewiring our brains in any significant way. But I guess that's yet to be determined. We'll see.
I noticed, you know, Jet in the Gents Book Conference in Killarney, she's a lesbian, and she spoke about how taking testosterone brought about a kind of an interest in males in the phallus. And then I saw Kira on Twitter, Kira Bell on Twitter, saying the same, and saying that she had, that this is in discussion among lesbians. And it was when Jet said it in Killarney, I'd heard it before. And I thought, really? Taking testosterone? Really? And I just think, what could be going on there? I just think we're in the halfway place trying to figure out hormones at this stage. They seem to have a huge impact on people.
Yeah, no, I thought that was fascinating too, because I hadn't heard that as well. I haven't given it, like, too much thought, except for, like, you know, female sexuality tends to be a little more broad and fluid, I suppose. And so if you're taking testosterone, that just is going to ramp up your libido to, you know, 11 out of 10. And so maybe they just become more open to, you know, a wider variety of things they never had been open to before. But I mean, I have no idea. That's just me spitballing. Neither. But it's really fascinating, because you would assume just basically the opposite, that, like, you would become hyper, attracted
into lesbians,
female bodies, but apparently not. Or maybe they're more attracted just to everyone. Like, who knows?
It's brain melting, really.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one quick thing I'll say about this, and then maybe we'll shift over into our listener exclusive content. You know, young people who are deeply ingrained in this ideology are, I think, being impacted really, really strongly by these ideas. So we have kids who are, you know, ostensibly in a same-sex relationship, but let's say they both identify as trans. They are kind of flipped, you know, so it's like a girl who identifies a boy, and she says that she has a girlfriend that's a boy identifying as a girl, and the parents are confused, or, you know, one kid says they're non-binary, and, like, to them, the concept of sexual orientation being based on sex is very foreign, because they just kind of were steeped in these ideas that it's all about your identity. So I wonder how much it is perhaps, I mean, there's no telling, right? Like, because people are adaptable and malleable. So maybe, like, if I was to make a really strong kind of, like, devil's advocate argument, well, humans are just going to adapt to this new confusing language. But what I feel is that this is probably delaying the process of solidifying and clarifying, crystallizing their sexuality, because they're genuinely, like, so confused about what they see with their own eyes. Like, so much of what we've talked about today with you, Colin, is, like, when you have a fundamental premise about something, that isn't based in reality. You're not allowed to trust your eyes. Like, you're not allowed to make observations. Like, they weren't allowed to observe the orbits of the planets and make, like, the most clear distinction. Like, they had to center the Earth. And likewise, yeah, with this gender stuff, it's like, no, we can't just talk about biological sex and most people are straight and boys and girls. Like, you actually have to make the exception the rule. And so you have to scramble all these things. I don't yeah. know.
Yeah. Well, what it does, I think, a lot is it, you know, again, like, the evolution isn't going to be changing, but I think in certain social contexts, like, it teaches people to sort of ignore a lot of evolved impulses that they might have, you know, like, oh, there's a man in the girl's bathroom. And we're telling little girls that, like, that's actually a woman. You're not allowed to say anything to that. To just dampen down their evolved responses that evolved for a reason, because, you know, a grown man in a space for women, like, you know, there's higher rates of, like, sexual violence and all that stuff. That's part of our evolutionary history, as unfortunate as that is.
Yeah.
So in that type of sense, absolutely. Like, I'm really concerned about just people suppressing those types of instincts, because I think it could be extremely damaging in that sense. Yeah.
And just before we go over to the exclusive content, what is your take on, let's say, the kind of the blank slatists who are saying, you know what I mean, there's no female behavior, there's no male behavior. It's hot online. Like, this is a big topic. It seems to me that anytime I try to say that there's stereotypically female behavior or stereotypically male, it feels like I'm saying something outrageously controversial these days.
It goes back to this inability or unwillingness to look at, like, what a normal distribution is and overlapping distributions between things. Like, when people and biologists say that, like, men and women are different, they don't mean that, like, they're just so categorically different in, like, their personalities. Or the women have different personalities than men. We're not saying every woman has totally different personalities than every single man. And we understand this. It's easy for people to know this when we say something like, men are taller than women.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone sort of understands what that means. We're talking about sort of averages, because everyone knows a short guy who a lot of women are taller than. Everyone knows a really tall woman who's, you know, taller than a lot of men. So we have no problem, like, thinking in terms of the normal distribution and overlapping distributions and traits like height. But when we use other traits that maybe are, like, multivariate, like personality, where there's different ways and they can vary on different axes and much more complex, instead of just sort of a single, you know, overlapping sort of bell curve, it's more like a scatter plot or n-dimensional plot. You know, it's so three-dimensional, however many dimensions you want to measure it. But there's still, like, this overlap. And we can say that, like, yes, there's differences in male and female personalities and interests and all these types of things without saying that, like, oh, if there's no boy that likes to play with dolls or no girl that likes to play with trucks. Like, clearly there's exceptions, and merely pointing to an exception doesn't negate the general trend. You know, I often use things like male and female faces when I try to explain, like, what a male and female brain is. Because everyone can identify, like, a male and a female face just at a glance with, like, upwards of 90% accuracy. If you remove, like, makeup and all, you know, they've done the studies where they, you know, pull the hair digitally. They just remove everything except for just the face. But if you said, like, well, what makes a male face a male face? Well, it's not any one thing. You know, like, males have their eyes tend to be more set. We have a bigger, like, brow ridge, or jaws are like this. But it's not any one. It's like all of those things together nudged in certain ways. There's like a syndrome that, like, the testosterone does, and it changes all the features of the face in a certain direction. Doesn't mean that males can't have very feminine faces, or you can't have some women who have very masculine faces that you're going to mistake for a man. But, you know, is there any male or female face? Like, well, no, not one, but there's still, like, these measurable overlapping differences, sort of like a family resemblance type thing that we can point to. And people just need to, like, that's what they need to hold in their mind when they're thinking about things like, what is a male and a female brain? Like, well, it's not any one thing. Just like, it's not just like the eyes that make a male or a female face. It's just sort of a bunch of different things that are pushed in certain directions based on sort of the hormones they're exposed to and the genetics that they have. So Yeah, that's what we should be thinking about.
I actually have more questions and thoughts about that. And maybe what we'll do is we'll kind of pause here for our general audience. And then if you want to listen to the rest of our interview with Colin, please join us over there in our Substack. And of course, we'll link to the articles that you've written that we've mentioned and your GenSpec talk. And it was just so amazing to finally have you on. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us this week on Gender, A Wider Lens.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And be sure to visit us on Substack by going to widerlenspod.com. There you can join our listener community, access bonus content and resources, plus learn about additional ways to support the show.
Our discussions are for educational purposes and are not intended as a substitute for mental health services.